and welcome. You're listening to Life in Fractals. My name is Jodie White. This podcast is a slowly weaving thread. It features conversational interviews with people out in the world shining their light, doing their thing, at the crossroads where creative expression, holistic health, and grounded spirituality meet. Thank you for joining me. On this episode, I'll be speaking with Sean O'Gorman of Nyx, Electronic Drone Choir. Sean is a vocalist, composer, musical director, and co-founder of Nyx. Nyx are reshaping the role of the traditional female choir, testing the limits of organic and synthetic modulation to explore the full spectrum of collective female voice as an instrument. I was lucky enough to see Nyx live last year at the Hidden Notes Festival in Stroud, where they played in an old church. And I can honestly say I've never experienced anything quite like their performance. Almost akin to a ritual or a ceremony. I've known Sean for a little while now. Her creative energy is infectious, and I really wanted to understand where that came from. Her background, her history, how she gets into the space to create with her voice, with technology, and in collaboration with artists, vocalists, musicians. But before we dive into that, Sean was kind enough to share a track so you can get a bit of context about what they do and who they are. So what you can hear, the music underneath my voice, is a track called Mutualism, which was released in 2021, and it is epic. Mutualism is a metamorphic, meditative track embodying our relationship with nature, symbiosis, transformation, and collective consciousness. It was created over lockdown in 2020 through a remote collaboration between 14 multidisciplinary artists and Ma Moyo, aka Belinda Zawi. So I really hope you enjoy this conversation with Sean O'Gorman of Nyx. And if you do and you'd like to support this podcast, the best thing you can do is share it. If you'd like to keep in touch with me and what I'm doing, you can find me on Substack, where this podcast lives, and the address is lifeinfractals.substack.com, and I'm on Instagram, and that's at lifeinfractals. For more on Nyx, you can check out their Instagram, which is nyx.edc, and their website, nyx-edc.com. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of Life in Fractals with Sean O'Gorman of Nyx.
Delicious.
Cool.
Great.
Okay. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Jody.
Hello. Hello. So firstly, would you mind just introducing yourself in whatever way that feels good?
Cool. I'm Sean O'Gorman, and I am a vocalist and a composer and general kind of creative practitioner. And the main project that all of my work comes through is called Nyx, and we're an electronic drone choir, which basically means we work with different parts of the human voice and in a very choral way, but trying to use the natural, more kind of expansive, more experimental parts of the natural voice, and then see how that interacts and is expanded out even further through the use of technology. So mainly things like effects pedals and using Ableton a lot, and guitar pedals.
There's a lot to dig into.
So much.
And we will. So Nyx, as far as I know, Nyx is a goddess.
Mm.
So what's the, maybe we could start with the sort of the origins of the collective Nyx and how that came to be. Because it is, as far as I understand, it is a collective, but it also seems to be sort of driven by a few people.
Yeah.
So maybe we can dig into how Nyx came about.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't forget to answer it. Nyx, yeah, she's the goddess of the night, and she was born from chaos. And I think a lot of the origination of the project comes from the fact that I was looking to do something that was kind of testing the boundaries and pushing things a little bit further out of the traditional choral model that I'd been in for so long, especially with kind of female trans non-binary voices being used in specific ways. So I basically got to a point where I was just enjoying so much experimenting with my own voice through loads of kind of different effects processes. And I had such a strong history in choral music that I just had this kind of light bulb idea of like, what would happen if we all were in a room in like almost like a sound bath situation where there were all these people singing through effects and creating their own kind of ambient soundscape based music in the room live, and how would that look and how would that feel? And I was jamming with a couple of friends and we were experimenting with things, and it was all total chaos to begin with, which is quite apt with the name.
Perfect.
And then I met Philippa, who's actually, who's the other kind of director of Nyx. And she's also from New Zealand, weirdly, but we'd never met in New Zealand, which is also very weird because it's very small, especially in the creative industries. But we had a mutual, very, very close friend, Nicole, and she was always doing that thing of like, oh, you've got to catch up with my friend. She's amazing. And you're just doing that thing of like, yeah. And then I was at a festival in France and Normandy, and I just stumbled across Philippa and I was like, this girl is fucking awesome. And then we ended up kind of going out for a wine, and which ended up in like two bottles of rosé or something, and we were all just sharing our biggest creative dreams with each other. And then the kind of next day I woke up and she'd already started applying for Arts Council funding for this project. And then already started the ball rolling. So basically, like, she's like the dream person you want to make a project with, because I think so many of us is kind of we have so many amazing kind of creative ideas, but it's not necessarily in the musician or the artist's body to be able to really be motivated enough and skilled enough, because it is a really, really clear skill set, that role of someone that really gets things, like that producer kind of role that really gets things going and really is like genuinely passionate about that side of it. So she was just like the most dream angel I could have ever met. And then since then, and then we were also collaborating with another friend for a while, and there was three of us running it, and now it's back down to the two of us. And yeah, she's basically like my, I would say I probably have the closest relationship with Philippa that I have with anyone in my life. Like, she's probably the person I talk to every single day. It feels like we kind of co-parent this project. And the rest of the singers, like the rest of the collaborators that we work with, there's kind of a number of different people from the collective. And I say collective over... It's definitely myself and Philippa running it. So there is like a, there is a model of how it goes. Yeah. It's constantly evolving.
Yeah.
It would be totally dishonest to say that it's like an all even collective of people. It's me, myself and Philippa like on the day to day ground level getting shit done.
Yeah.
And then we have a group of like a pool of singers. And like, I wouldn't even say singers. They're like kind of artists working with their voices. Mm-hmm. And all of those people have their own practice of making music, making art. And a lot of those don't actually even come from music backgrounds necessarily. One of the people that's been in the project the longest, who you know, Shireen, they were actually their first practice was visual art and performance art. And they came into Nick's having never really used their voice.
Wow.
And then started experimenting with it and then just like loved that whole process. And then now really love singing. Mm. But, you know, it was so crazy to think that they'd never sung in front of people. And then all of a sudden we were like very quickly on very big stages singing in front of thousands of people. So like just the level of like... amazingness of that, you know, like the fact that it went so big so quick. But
when are we talking
this was like 2000, I feel like it's been going for about 6 years. I think it's about like 2018 feels like I'm not very good at maths, but mm-hmm. I don't even know what year we're in now, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, about 2018 was when we first started jamming, and we were, you know, all of us as well, like there was a couple of people with some technical backgrounds as well, but most of us were very like very new to any sort of technical equipment. So like I was definitely like I could record myself on Logic a little bit, and
okay.
I knew how to plug a microphone into a mixer kind of, but when we first started rehearsing, we would all go into like classic like band rooms and be like, okay, I've got this cool thing on my iPad, I'm going to use that. Or someone be like, I found this guitar pedal that makes your voice go backwards. And then
it was experimental.
It's really DIY.
Coming from like a training background.
Yeah,
where you'd already
totally.
Established. Yeah. Wow. Interesting.
Totally. And then we managed to get like Philippa again, such an amazing hustler. Like she kind of got us in touch with Ableton, who then started offering us free training. And then we all got like kind of on that boat. And then as soon as we all started working in Ableton, like that became kind of our hub of like how I would record the music, and then I would start composing songs and then sending out the files to everybody with their names. Like, and so instead of using like traditional like choral like scores of like Western notation sheet music, because mm-hmm. not everybody could read sheet music. Yeah. And also it's not really that's only one side of it when you're also having the effects. I was sending out Ableton files to people. And we still do this, and color coding everybody's names and be like, this is your part. You can just listen to this and learn by ear.
And how many people are we talking about at this point?
It's
so
difficult.
So you're composing for multiple voices.
Yeah.
And also composing for those voices being processed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a lot.
It's a lot.
And that's an amazing skill.
Yeah.
Not many people can do that, right?
Yeah. I think it's also it's also kind of slightly editing the way that I thought about choral music being less about singing a song together and more about using the voice as instrumentation, almost like you're composing for like an orchestral chamber group in a way.
Right.
So you're looking at the different frequencies and layers of like, it's almost like a painting and figuring out where the space is. I see it very visually. Mm-hmm. That's also where I find Ableton and any kind of DAW kind of thing really helpful, because I can see everything much more clearly, yeah. like a big map of everything.
Right.
So
then you're developing sort of like motifs and repetitive cycles of bits that slot in and out.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And then also I think that the other thing is it's like, it's like every singer interacts with their own equipment different. So this is, yeah, I'll go back a little bit. So the process is I create a composition, usually in Ableton, usually just using my voice. That's layered usually between 6 to 8 parts. Then I'll name the parts to people. People then receive that file. They can hear the dry version of mm-hmm. like what I've sung in originally. Mm-hmm. Then they can click on the, you know, up the wet signal of whatever effects are on, and they mm-hmm. can hear what needs to be done. Then they'll take away that information and they'll get their own setup, whether that's guitar pedals, whether that's like a TC Helicon or a Boss unit,
okay.
and interpret what I've done okay. in their own way. Because everybody's got their own setups and their own practice with their setup. So whatever I'm giving them is just an indication of like, right. this is kind of what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And whatever we can't achieve from the voices, we just put back into the track. So we do work with tracks sometimes not. But most of what you hear is just affected voices like on stage. But so the process of that is also, then we have to get into the room together, and it's slightly more like a jazz model. Like, it's like, you know what the framework of the piece is,
mm-hmm.
you know what the kind of the motifs are, the chords are, but we're waiting for the layering. Like we're in a bit of a deep listening process, and like you would go first and then this person would go next and then this person would go next, but it's very, very organic and intuitive. So it's building the piece together.
Where's the line between composition and improvisation?
There is a lot of improvisation. So it's really funny as well, because I'm definitely like, I really realize the hypocrisy in a lot of my direction as a musical director. And we all laugh about it hard. I'm like, you know, be yourself, do your thing. You reinterpret it this way, but also do exactly what I say in the exact way I just described it. So I'm very like, I do laugh at myself a lot of the time, but
do you have to rein that in a little bit?
I have to work on it a lot, yeah. Like, I think I'm sure we'll go into this later on, but the kind of the musical management direction layers of the work that I do is definitely, like, just as important as any other bit. Like, the emotional kind of mental challenges of, like, both singing this intense music and then also running and holding the space for the whole group while they're also in that process. And when we're in like really intense, like for some reason, we don't seem to do small gigs. We're only ever doing like massive gigs on massive stages and with a lot of people in the group that don't have, like, they haven't come from like a performance background, and the level of nerves are really high. The level of intensity is really high.
Yeah.
There's always like some kind of high pressure person in the audience and you're like, oh God. And then there's that, or like we're in a really intense recording situation where we're in like, someone's paid us to do something crazy and like a computer game or like a big installation. So it's like, you know, and then the clients paid for the space. So you're like, okay, everyone, I really want everyone to really like be themselves and like be really honest with yourself and focus on your wellness. But also we've got a job to do.
Yeah.
And so that's a massive thing as well. It's just like, okay, it's taught me a lot about myself. It's taught me a lot about like how to, both myself and Philippa, you know, we talk about this constantly, you know, there's like, even just the group dynamics of trying to be in like a really transparent kind of open source collective based model of like working with people. This was, you know, when you're really kind of trying to focus on people's, like people really being able to be themselves and bring themselves into the space. But then there's also just this the kind of like, okay, we're really wanting people to bring this level of vulnerability into the music. But also then there's this personal level of like, okay, but what does that mean as a human being to be bringing this? So it's like we're all learning how to keep ourselves like really resilient and really, really clear and be like, right, actually today I can only bring 10% and I have to be very honest about that. And I have to save myself until the moment that we have to go super hard. And so, but you don't always know that, you know, like, so it's like it's a constant.
I guess, yeah, because you're managing that many inputs in terms of people and emotions. Yeah, and
it's so intense.
Physical inputs.
Yeah.
There's a lot to, there's a lot to be aware of.
Yeah.
For everybody, I guess, and for you as the sort of the book stops here person.
Yeah.
And when you're doing that live, I mean, when I saw you in Stroud, are you submixing everything yourself? Are you kind of in control of the live mix?
No. We have we always have a front of house engineer doing all of that. And we're working with someone for this upcoming show who's developing it with us before we get into the room. But usually because of, we're a totally self-managed group and self-funded.
Mm-hmm.
We fund from getting money from projects and putting the money back into the project.
Yeah.
And also, the days of Arts Council funding seem to be slowly drying up, but we're really careful with how we spend that money, and the nature of the fees available for shows mean that we actually can't afford a technician usually. Mm-hmm. So we do rely on whatever the space is to provide us a technician.
Mm-hmm.
But most of those technicians usually...
it's quite specific.
It's really specific and it's really hard. It's not like a setup where they can see, the guitar is giving me a signal that's too loud or the bass needs to be turned up or down. It's like you're just looking at a whole set of people with microphones.
And how do you even sound check that? Because you've got such a range of volume, such a range of feeling in what you're doing, and then the range of kind of the digital stuff as well as just the purity of the voices.
Yeah.
That must be such an interesting thing for a sound engineer to process.
Interesting is a nice way of framing it. You've always got to hope that they're like, yay, a really incredible, beautiful frequency challenge. Actually, it depends where you are and what's going on. But we always have to spec for at least the minimum I think we can get away with is about a 3-hour sound check. And that restricts us a lot at the moment. Well, hopefully one day we'll be at the point where we've just got a whole busload of roadies being like boom 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 and we're just like really up
the
there
setup. Yeah,
but for now, when we're still at this kind of extremely DIY level, we have to form really good relationships with the team in advance. So we do a lot of work in advancing. Like I spend a lot of my time creating really beautiful, amazingly color-coded tech specs with people's photos and people's pronouns and people's equipment and how they like to be addressed and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
I know I put a lot of energy into it, but I can't force someone to read it. You get there and you feel like you've had the conversations with the people, and then like all of these massive venues often have, it's just a huge turnover of staff. So constantly you're going to turn up, and no matter how much work you've done, someone won't know what the deal is and you have to start from scratch. And I think to me, it's just on every level of Nix, whenever we're working with anybody, it's all about developing a really clear relationship with someone and a communication with someone. So we've been very lucky to only have experienced that classic kind of sound engineer, usually white, middle-aged male situation where they're just like, oh, sweethearts, this is how we do it. Don't worry. That kind of shit.
Yeah.
We haven't really come across that too often. Mm.
I guess the sorts of events and things that you've been performing at maybe lend themselves to somebody who's a little bit more open-minded. And
yeah, exactly. So we haven't experienced too much of it. Everyone in the collective has come across that in their own way. We have had some absolute shockers though, but the majority of the time it's just been incredible, amazing people that are really like, wow, I'm really excited for this challenge today. As much advancing as that can be done as possible, and just also really surrender to the fact that it's always going to be a bit of a shit show. Just knowing that you're like, okay, the next 4 hours are going to be really difficult. So can everybody just remain really present? Please stay off your phones. This is going to be a bit boring, but we're going to have to go. And each one of you is going to have to, it's also a really good lesson for everyone in the group to be able to speak what they need. Because I think especially the group of people being primarily like female trans non-binary group, it's like a lot of us have grown up kind of not being not that confident to like really push for what we need, especially when the environment is like telling you this is what you should do.
Yeah. Oh, it's very male dominated.
Yeah, exactly. So they're kind of, that has been a massive lesson in like trying to make sure everybody feels confident that they can ask to be turned up in their monitor, or you're not putting anyone out of the way by just asking for what you need. So that's been a process for us as well. And I think the other thing is to be, you know, even the, just even the concept of like being silenced in a sound check is so funny, isn't it? It's just such an ironic situation. But it's like, even knowing that when there's like a moment of like huge level of feedback happening and everyone's like, ah, you know, our tendency is to all just switch our shit off. And I think it's like, even that is just like, actually, you've got to let this, like, it's not your fault. Like, someone else is in control of that, and you can let them, you can let them do that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There's got to be so many levels there that, you know, I will never understand from my lived perspective.
We've all experienced it though, haven't we?
Like, sure.
Just that.
But it's different for females, you know?
Yeah.
There's something different there, where you're all so clear and so you know yourself so well. And that really, I think that translates in what we hear in a performance.
Yeah.
The communication levels, everyone knows where they stand. There's trust, there's like deep trust, it seems, in the collective.
Yeah.
And I'm gathering like that, you have to have that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we work a lot with our, we actually have a colleague on board, Imogen Knight, and she is an embodiment director and like a somatic intimacy coordinator on films, TV, live music. She works with orchestras a lot. And she comes in and she does a lot of work. I run the workshops with her now as well.
Oh, okay.
She's like, does an incredibly deep level of like coming back into the body and making sure, again, all the sound comes from the body, like the work that we've done with Katia and Bethan.
Mm-hmm.
A similar / slightly different kind of angle on that. But I think that makes a massive difference. I think saying I'm not sure if it comes from a place of necessarily knowing ourselves or even knowing what we're doing that well, but I think we're giving ourselves permission to like really, really let go into the music. You're letting yourself embody the music to the point where it becomes almost like the music is your character, like that you can kind of offload your own stuff with yourself and be like, right, I'm just going to fully embody the music now. And it's almost like coming on stage and becoming a character, but you're becoming like, you're letting yourself fully be the music. And I think that's also what's useful with the range of the music, because people could be going anywhere from kind of being the voice of like an alien kind of like creature to having a full blown like chanting, like wild kind of wailing, like mid voice kind of belt moment, to some really beautiful kind of operatic moments. And there's also a lot of the time, because the set is so kind of cinematic and it goes through these big ebbs and flows, it's actually changed again. So I'm wondering, it's changed quite significantly since the last time you saw it.
We'll get onto that.
Yeah. But the spaciousness of it also means that for some people, there's a good 10 minutes where they're on stage not doing anything. Like a lot of them do have moments where they like when we're on a Hidden Notes was a much smaller stage, but there's a number of moments when we're on a bigger stage where a lot of them go into the center of the room and just lay down and feel the vibrations of what's happening. You know, it's bringing presence to every single moment on stage. And I think that permission to be present in those moments is really amazing, because when you're playing in a band and you're like, have a song where you're not really on, or like, you know, like you're just doing one thing, it's really awkward. Like you have a kind of sense of like, oh, am I needed here? Or what are people looking at me? And you're not quite sure what to do with your body. Whereas this is giving full permission to be like, I can actually now just like rest in this bed of sound while it's time for someone else to take that sonic space. I'm gonna still take up space with my presence here.
And it seems to me, because of the nature of what Nix is, and you're not just going to go and do the toilet circuit in London pubs.
No.
Every live event that you do has a sort of ceremonial feel to it. It's like there's a specialness to it.
Yeah.
And even just the whole, the performance itself feels very like a ritualistic thing, right? I mean, I don't know how built-in designed that is.
Mm.
Like, I know you're interested in that kind of stuff outside of music, but do you feel like that has become more of an overt part of the performance side of things? Or is it just sort of, it's been like a natural progression into it because we're having to have such presence when we perform, it sort of naturally becomes like ceremonial.
Yeah, I think it's that. I don't, at no point are we like, we're not doing that thing where we're all backstage, like saging ourselves and be like, it's the time. But I mean, we do have rituals before and after, especially, is really important. And I definitely want to talk about that a bit more, but like,
yeah, I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah. I think the nature of the music is incredibly, ceremonial, ritualistic. It goes through various forms. I mean, I think the way I write is incredibly like, it is like I'm in a giant ceremony and it's got all of the darkness, all of the lights, all of the silliness, all of the kind of scariness. It's got everything going. It flows through everything of that. There's always a purge. There's always like a, there's always a big purge. There's always a joyfulness. There's always a coming together, a unifying space. So I think the music in itself is there. I think the presence required when you're performing that, like not only practicing that music and singing it, but then performing it adds a whole nother dimension of like intensity.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this, that you've got all of this kind of energy being placed upon you from the audience as well, which is feeding into this kind of cycle of ceremonial intensity, which you're then feeding back out.
It's quite unusual. I'm just casting my mind back to watching it, and just as an audience member and taking it all in, it just doesn't feel like any other. I mean, it's unusual to get that that effect as a listener in a live space, like where I felt like I was on a journey. I was going through all sorts of stuff. I was being confronted with my own, you know, my own shit through feeling what was coming up from the music. And it felt like this kind of this sort of like contemporary coven.
Yeah,
was bringing. It was wild. It's really wild. So I can't imagine how what it takes to be able to be part of that as a performer.
Yeah,
so many layers. And it, so like you say, it many is layers. Really intense.
It's really intense, and I only, you know, the more I do it, the more I realize how intense it is and how intense of a process it is for people to be in the space witnessing it. Like we all, you know, like a common occurrence when we're performing is like people will walk out because it's too much.
I was on the edge at one point.
I love it. I freaking love it when people walk out.
The chanty one that was like super dark. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then like after about 10 minutes, I'm like, oh my God.
When will they stop?
But it's like, it's really interesting to observe the reactions in yourself. This stuff is like, why is this happening? Why do I feel like this? Like there's something really valuable to bringing the challenge of not just a pretty sound. To music as a whole, really.
Yeah.
Especially with a female-led choir.
Yeah.
There's something great about seeing you guys just going for it with all the emotions, with all the messiness, with all the darkness, like you say.
Yeah.
I think that's great, and I love that. So,
thank you. I mean, we would have all been burnt at the stake had this been a different period in time, like for sure. Like, I think that's it. It's like, again, it's like you've been given permission to make the most intense, like to embody the most intense things that you possibly can on stage with these incredible lights that Philippa designs and like these amazing costumes that like amplify, you know, like we've got these beautiful costumes designed by Tom Scott, who's like an incredible designer. And like the, you know, Philippa works heaps with the silhouetting of the light, and which again, it just only enhances and amplifies these shapes and this intensity. And it almost feels like we're kind of going into battle with these giant armors.
It's very otherworldly to watch.
Yeah.
Like you sort of feel like you're taking part in a moment out of time.
Yeah, it is like that, isn't it? It's just, yeah, it's an incredibly, I'm in constant awe that I'm like, how has this possibly become my job? What did I do to get to this point?
What did you do to get to this point?
Next question. What a segue. Yeah, good question.
Let's talk about your background a little bit. Like, how did you, what's your sort of musical journey been like? And how did you come to be composing for such wild...
Yeah.
Wild and experimental music?
Good question. I mean, I was definitely one of those little children that was like, everybody stop what you're doing, I'm doing a show, you know? Like, I made the invites, I collected the flowers, I did like, you know, like I'd choreograph everything for me and my sister, I'd learn all the pieces, I'd, you know, like, go so hard into these like performance events. And luckily I had parents that probably found it really funny, because they every video I now watch, I realize, oh, this was actually funny for you. But they really encouraged it. And they, you know, and then when I was 10, I joined the opera and I was in the opera chorus. And that was like my first, you know, I was on massive stages from age 10. Being in choruses of like big shows. And I just was obsessed with being on stage. I loved being in the opera, is just how I jumped into it, because a friend was already in that.
And I mean, opera age 10.
Opera age 10,
that sounds not like your everyday 10-year-old's musical experience.
No.
Talk a bit more about that, maybe.
Yeah. I mean,
How did you get into that?
I know. It was because I sang. I went to a really intensely Catholic primary school, which we could go into in a whole other podcast of that level. Which explains my draw to the cult, though, you know? The cult and the esoteric.
Yeah.
But I spent, you know, that was my introduction to being like, okay, I love making music and I have a place to make music all the time, sing songs, create harmonies. My sister and I used to walk to school every day and we'd sing songs and we'd harmonize and we'd do all this kind of stuff. Started playing the recorder. Absolute classic. But I didn't just play the recorder. I then started playing the recorder, and then I was in like the New Zealand Youth Recorder Orchestra. Like I would just, anything I would do, I'd be like, I need to do this 2,500%.
Are you a Capricorn by any chance?
No, I'm a Pisces. It's very unusual, but with a Leo rising. So okay. It makes more sense.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And also, so part of going to church as well was the church that I was at in New Zealand. We had a very multicultural primary school. I'd say actually, like, as white kids, we were like the minority in our school. Mm. So we had a lot of Pacific Island, Māori, Polynesian, Asian kids. And it meant that the community was kind of like, there was different forms of Catholicism that fed into it. So each week, the church would be led by a different priest from one of those places. So we had like a Samoan priest, Tongan priest, we had a Filipino priest, and we had an Irish priest. And I want to say ceremony because that's how I remember it now. But each
that's amazing.
Day, yeah. So each time, each Sunday, you'd get like a different energy towards it, or you get a different cultural perspective of that.
Sure.
And you'd get different music. And honestly, growing up in a Samoan choir church where everybody, like Samoan people to me are like the most, like I grew up with so many Samoan friends, and their connection to music, dancing, singing, collective, like singing especially, it's almost like they were born in six-part harmony. So like the uplifting, like I loved going to church for those songs. And everyone in the church, you know, like there'd be the bits where the women would be singing and it would be split into three parts, and then the men would join in like a whoa, and it was just so amazing.
And that's really interesting because I mean, they're not, then that's not their native, you know, religion, so they're They're Catholic, but they're bringing in, what were the songs? Kind of like old songs? They're not hymns,
some
right?
Some of them were hymns like reimagined.
Ah, okay.
Hymns reimagined, but a lot of them were, you know, they were sung in Samoan.
Yeah.
So you'd also be singing a different language, which was also really fun. And like their language is so much more like vowel, like they're a lot more like a, e, o, u, and like u, kind of vibes, which is so much more fun to sing in, especially if you're in church singing, being like Lamb of God and shit like this. You're just like, give me some good juice. So like that was my first like explosion into like, oh my God, harmonies, you know, harmonies, my heaven. And then my best friend at the time, Marlena, she is from a huge Samoan family, and she is now like a very amazing professional opera singer. I think she's sung at the Met and stuff.
Oh,
so she joined the opera, and I was like, I want to do what Marlena's doing. So I jumped in as well. And then I just became this opera chorus kid, and that was all I wanted to do. And then I joined the National Youth Choir when I was about 13. So I was the youngest person in that. And then I just got so into choral singing, and I just loved it. I just loved that feeling of like, A, being part of something where you'd be like, wow, all these cool kids from all over the country, and they're all kind of a mixture of like super geeky choir people, but also really interesting kind of alternative thinking people. What about
how it made you feel though? Because I imagine that like...
it was heaven.
Because choral music is so... I mean, I feel like there's a difference between... when it's sort of there are words versus when it's just washes of sound, but still like being part of, anyone who's experienced singing in a group in any form really will know the kind of magic of that. And
it's so amazing. It's
as
like
as a youngster kind of getting into, I wonder how much the feeling of just being in that group and singing kind of brought you to further down that road.
Exactly. I think having, again, like going back to that feeling of like, okay, I've grown up in the church, but obviously like there's all this kind of weird psycho-spiritual thing going on where you're like, I don't quite believe in this. I find this a bit weird and very, again, hypocritical, even as a small child being like, why is Jesus talking about being kind, but then everyone's smacking their kids and we're all getting to, you know, like it didn't make sense. And then like, what? It never made sense. And I was like, kind of like, you know, you have all these big questions, like what is God and all this kind of stuff. But I had it, you know, but you don't necessarily have that sense of it. But when it would come to singing, especially in the groups of people, you'd obviously have some kind of like embodied reaction of like,
yeah, it transcends all the kind of dogma or the
exactly. Yeah. And that to me is where, okay, so this is what, you know, God is, or this experience of like being subsumed into something much more than yourself, or the sum of every individual part.
Yeah.
So I think when I got into a really good choir where everyone was really tuned in, and we'd spend the whole day working with how much we could get these kind of harmonics going up with each other and like blending voices so that everyone in the unit was working as this one big whole, was so amazing, because it brings up so many things. It's like on a sonic level, it's so joyful. It's like, wow, the tuning is perfect. The kind of the harmonies are amazing. And also the work of this choir was like, you sang so many different pieces from all around the world. You sang in so many different languages, so many different types of music, through from like early music all the way through to contemporary.
Oh, wow.
And so you got so much of a breadth of sound to sink into, and obviously some you'd prefer some to the other, but you also had that sense of like, okay, there's like 60 of us, all these young people, this is what you can make if you actually all dedicate your energy to one thing. So there was that other level of it that I was like, wow, this is the potential of human beings, you know, this is beyond music. Like, imagine if we could all organize ourselves this well
and have that experience together.
Yeah, have this experience together, making something together.
Yeah, and the kind of thing that where it becomes, you know, it's about the collective rather than the individual.
Exactly.
To a point, right?
Yeah.
Which is quite transcendent for, especially when you're a teenager.
Yeah, completely. So then I was in that, and then I started. Then I went to uni, and I was like, I did what a lot of people do, which is like, I love singing. I love being in the opera. Kind of, oh, one moment callers. Someone's coming to get the vacuum cleaner. And then I had that thing where I was like, right, I'm going to study this at uni. And so I got into like the best singing school and I started going much deeper into like training to be a classical singer.
Okay.
So I went to the singing school to deepen my studies in that. And that's when shit started getting a bit intense and everything started switching from what was previously a very joyful, very collective experience to becoming very individual, very mental, very kind of, kind of technical. And I had an incredibly amazing teacher who was very, like, I'm very grateful for the level of like depth of technical training that I have. But also, as I've talked to a number of like recovering classical musicians in this realm, it's really traumatizing. So I, you know, like the part of the singing training was like, like you'd have group sessions twice a week where you'd get up and you'd sing a piece that you'd been working on and everyone in the group would then, you'd finish and then everyone would be like, you did this wrong. I think you could do this better. You could do this better. Your language is not right here. And then you'd be forced to watch that video again.
Oh, wow.
And learn it again. And I actually, about a year in, I ended up losing my voice completely, having to go see a voice therapist, like an ear, nose and throat therapist, who was like, your speaking voice is at a really difficult frequency and you need to change the way you speak. And you also need to take all this like reflux medication. And I was like, you know, at that time just believed things like that and didn't realize on reflection now I'm like, oh, I was just couldn't handle this level of pressure. Yeah. And it wasn't the right route for me. And it was definitely the right route for some people. Like it really worked for some people. Like
you
thrive
off that.
Yeah. I mean, some people just, you know, some people just work in different ways. Mm. But a lot of the people that I went to uni with, who I would actually say like in terms of their kind of natural talent of their voice, I would have never expected anything. But because they had that kind of very disciplined, like very like hardcore ethic of just training super hard every day, a lot of them are singing now on like huge stages, right. And they've really gotten somewhere with it because they kept going and they kept going, yeah. Kept going. But it was almost to the level of like, we're training for like a sports person would train.
Yeah. I like, you know, there's not much more you can fit in your life.
There's not much more
because
your
life revolves around that. Right. And I guess, yeah, some people can do that and there's some sacrifices involved, I guess, but.
So then I finished that training. I did manage to kind of find my voice. I got over the intense shutdown of the throat, but I wouldn't say I ever got to a point with singing at uni where I was like feeling like I was doing it right. I was constantly feeling like I was doing it wrong. Also, you paid so much, like it was like the same level as getting like a medical degree. So you spent so much money on this training, knowing that it's not like a doctor either. It's not like you're going to make that
guaranteed money
back.
Yeah.
So you'd be, you know, like my uni was like,
I guess
the most expensive because you had so much personal training.
Right.
And then I got out of that and I then auditioned for the same opera company I'd been in since being a child, but as an adult.
Okay.
And I didn't get in.
Ah.
And that was the first thing my whole life that I hadn't gotten into. And I was mortified.
Do you think that had anything to do with the sort of like
I think it was the universe being like, do something else, babes. So yeah. And I also, what's amazing in New Zealand is you can actually do multiple degrees at the same time. So at the same time as studying music, I also studied a design degree, like a environmental design / communication design degree, which I loved as well. And I just started going down that route more because I was like, well, you know, I was also in the mindset at that time of being like, well, this is going to get me more money. I really enjoy this. I was also really good at that. But then I decided to move to the UK and I had kind of stopped doing music really because I just found it, music to me was only opera singing or choir singing. Then I got to the UK and I thought a good way of making friends would be to join a new choir and I won't know anyone and it'll be lovely.
Hang on.
Yeah.
You just said, oh, I moved to the UK there as if it was nothing, as if it was moving, you know.
I moved to the other side of the world, having never even visited.
So, yeah. So what happened there?
It's a very again, it's like a cultural thing. It's a very, New Zealand is like a very, it's a country that is like a small village. So there's like such an urge to get the hell out of there once you finish uni.
Okay.
So, you know, even though there's only 5 million people from New Zealand that exist, you've met so many of them, surely. Like everyone knows lots of Kiwis. Yeah, and if you think about how many of them there are versus how many of them you've met,
right,
it's because they all travel. They go everywhere. Right. Like you will always find a Kiwi somewhere. Like, and there's not that many of them. They're rare. So it's really weird that you find so many of them. And it's because there's a huge culture of like, get me out of here.
Okay. So it's kind of normalized in a way.
It's really normal. Yeah, they've even got like, you know, paying, like going back to the cost of my tuition, like you don't have a student loan, like you don't have interest on a student loan in New Zealand if you stay in New Zealand, because they have got such a drain of people, because everyone finishes their degree
and just
leaves
goes
for 10 years and then comes back.
Right.
So there's an incentive not to leave,
right,
that you don't, because I ended up paying off a load of mine and then leaving to come to the UK. And within a year, it was right back up. Like
the interest
had just come back up.
Yeah.
So like, let's just never think about that ever again. Let's just let that fester.
Probably best.
Yeah. So moved to
the
UK.
Did you know people here though? You must have known, but there are other New Zealanders here.
Yeah, yeah, there's always, there's bloody millions of them.
Everywhere.
Yeah. I did, and I moved with a partner who at the time, I kind of wanted to move to Scotland, but he wanted to move to London. So we moved to London. Yeah, and then through that, I kind of felt the sense of relief as well, because I felt like I could maybe do something slightly different in music, because there's just more opportunity to be a little bit, A, more anonymous, and B, there is just more, there are more places to, there's more kind of places to do little kind of like.
And I guess just more inspiration to do something that's just original, right?
Exactly. So I spent a couple of years and I was kind of a creative director at London Contemporary Voices. And I worked with them for a while. And then we did a lot more kind of a big kind of arrangements of more contemporary alternative music. And then through that, I kind of rediscovered my love of arranging. And I've always loved like making vocal arrangements of things. Mm. But at that time, I was probably still a little bit, I listened to things that I did and I was like, this is really cool, but this is so Glee, which I loved. But now, then I kind of.
It's all part of an evolution though, right?
I think
you
so,
you got to kind
of
understand all aspects of, you know, it's quite.
Yeah. But so LCV also started very, it started from something and then it got very big very quickly. And so then they managed it in a particular way. And then we also started working a lot as session singers. So I was doing a lot of session singing for some really big people. I did session singing for like Goldie, Alt J, Laura Envola, Imogen Heap, like loads of stuff, like amazing people.
So getting
people
into the whole recording side of things.
And live, like performing at like massive festivals and stuff. Like it was very fun performing with Goldie, I got to say. That was like absolutely nuts. Like
I
doing
bet
like
that was great.
So cool. Like so cool. And we did a couple of proms at the Royal Albert Hall. And so I was like, wow, I've hit all these kind of like life achievements of like, wow, I've sung at the bloody Albert Hall. I've like performed at like these massive festivals and it's just like, okay, cool. But I was also at that time a bit like, is that all there is being a session singer? Kind of being like, especially in a lot of these recording situations, especially being a woman, especially it's like you have to look a certain way and you have to sing really long, sustained notes. No vibrato. I remember recording like I recorded an album with Albo as well once, and that was really fun. But it was just like, I feel like I'm a decoration.
Right. I mean, it's not your creativity either, you know.
No, not necessarily. And I was really good at it, so I was just really like drawn to it because I was like, okay, this is I can
and
do
it's
this,
fun,
and
you
it's
know,
fun
to do that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Totally. And you would like really getting the egotistical boxes were like really well ticked. And it was all good and it was paid really bloody well and it was just like cool. But then I was just like, there's got to be more than this.
Mm.
And that's when I first started kind of getting into the Nick's world and being like, okay, what could we do here? How could we work? It was like exactly what you were talking about before. It's like, okay, how can we start reclaiming sounds that people don't consider to be pretty, mm-hmm. because that's so that was so deeply ingrained into me. Like, women need to sound a certain way when they're singing, especially in a choral situation. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like, I feel like the last couple of years to me have been like unlearning and like really pushing what all this like classical choral operatic training had done. It was like, actually, do you know what? I'm going to start doing pieces where everybody says their consonants at different times, because there were so many things in like choral singing when they're like, we must say the S all together on this beat. Okay. And now I'm like,
but almost like you almost need that. It's the classic thing, isn't it? You almost need that level of prior understanding and training to be able to deconstruct it later.
I think so.
And then go, I know what I'm actually doing here.
Yeah.
I'm kind of doing the opposite. And I know I've been and experienced the other side of it, I can now sort of deconstruct it and do something different.
Totally. Mm. I often think that because I teach a lot of workshops now as well. And I do a lot of kind of like authentic voice and like deep voice work as where I've met you. Mm. I hold space for a lot of that now. And I sometimes find myself being really almost jealous of people that are coming into it from a point of like, I've never really used my voice before. I don't have any training. I'm really nervous to use my voice. And then I watch them kind of break through into a moment where they're just like, wow, I was so like in the body and I was so doing this. And I'm like, wow, because even now when I'm teaching that, I've still got all of this old kind of like kind of brain feedback loop of all the people that were sitting in the room being like, you did this wrong, you did this wrong, you did this wrong, like living in my head. So I've learned really deeply, and actually through a lot of work with like psychedelics and singing, to really kind of like have a different relationship with that. But having like, it's, I find also with working with people that come into NICS, we've got a lot of like very experienced singers and a lot of people that come from much more of a DIY background who haven't had any form of classical or any form of training. And just the difference in the way that what they bring, it's like some people you need to kind of help lift them up and give them confidence, and other people it's more like, we need to help you unlearn a lot of this like extremely like over performative kind of stuff, mm-hmm. where you feel like you've got to be like, you know, you've got to do the jazz hands or do the Beyonce things, which is like, I've definitely got time for that. But like, you know,
when it's
like,
performative and it's not authentic.
When it's feeling like it's coming from a, because that's the thing, it's
the
like
headspace.
And it's also coming, like, I think a lot of like training also, you're being trained a lot of the time to sing like someone else. Mm-hmm. You're listening to, you're like, okay, this is the style of singing we're going to teach you, which makes you sound like this. It doesn't make you sound like yourself. Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing. And that the main kind of like blending challenge I have with NICS is that I'm bringing in people that are very their own artist. And that's actually much harder to blend together than people that are kind of coming together for singing just like a choir, mm-hmm. because it doesn't have the same, like everyone's so, their timbres, their everything is so different. They're not chosen because they blend well. They're chosen because I love their individuality.
Ooh.
But when it comes to blend, so the thing that we actually find the most difficult in NICS is the perfect choral moments that I also love a couple of those, you know, like I would never want to do the whole thing like that. But we have a couple of moments where everyone's singing all together, quite traditional choral style. Mm. And those are the hardest, especially with, you know, especially in the tech setup we've got, because everybody, instead of being in like a tightly knit group, everyone's like kind of spaced out on stage, just using a monitor. You know, or in ears, which are the whole different realm of people getting stuck into their head. So I'm not a fan of in ears. I'm not a fan of in ears.
Interesting.
I hope I get there one day, but for singing, I find it, I need that connection with that kind of acoustic connection with my ears. Otherwise I can almost do it, but not when I'm trying to bring that into everybody else's stuff as well. So that's my main journey with it. I think, I don't know where I got lost on the train somewhere, but yeah, I got to the point where I was just like, nah, let's experiment around with this. And that's how I got there. But it was through a long journey of, as you say, the kind of deconstruction of what had been learned before. But I am now at the point where I'm like, actually, I want to reclaim some of that slightly more, I've been so anti reading scores and doing everything really kind of, this is how music should be composed and da-da-da. I've been so kind of free form that I'm a little bit more like, actually I would quite like a bit more relearning of structures and especially as I'm starting to compose a lot more for kind of film and TV stuff.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. Mm. So I'm a bit more like,
yeah,
finding out a little bit more about how that can inform different decisions without getting too stuck in the head. I think
you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
No, you've got
a load of skills that are useful.
Yeah.
So why not use them?
Mm. Yeah, I think so. Why not see how they could have a relationship together? I think maybe some more, slightly more rational mind-based decisions with the body rather than being like, you can only have one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's the place I'm at now.
So in terms of recordings with Nix, you've done bits and bobs over the last few years, EPs and little kind of we haven't even talked about the Gazelle Twin thing as well, which is amazing. Deep England.
Oh, so good.
But yeah, I saw very recently you've announced that you're putting out a full sort of the first album, I guess, full length album.
Yeah, we are. And that has been coming for so long. I've wanted to do that for so long, but it's happened exactly when it needs to happen. And so we're recording it in April, and that is like a culmination of all of the composition work we've been doing since the start. I think when we started, the first projects we did were four concerts as part of a kind of emergent series of collaborations with mostly solo female electronic music makers. And we did that as a way to kind of launch ourselves.
Yeah, and you've done some kind of artist collaborations, haven't
you? Yeah, we've done a lot of collaborations, but that first series was almost like, okay, we're using this as an opportunity to launch ourselves into the world, but also create a musical language. And that's where it kind of all began, was back then. And it's been slowly kind of churning through the collaborative work, which has kept us kind of, which has kept like anchor points in the process. And then we've performed on our own quite a few times, but the next solo live stuff is like, where our kind of the deep core of our hearts are. That's like the cornerstone of the work. And the album is like kind of a reflection of that. So there's a lot of stuff that you would have seen at Hidden Notes that will be in there, plus some totally new ones, which are also in the live version. And yeah, it's really exciting. And I keep changing my mind about it every single day and where we'd put things and what we'd do. But to me now, it's almost like we get the recording and we get all the stuff and then we play around with it, because so much of Nix is remixing and remixing and then relayering.
Okay.
So, you know, what you hear in the recording studio is almost never what it sounds like afterwards as well. There's a huge element of like reproduction and relayering.
And that's a massive part of the creative process as well.
Yeah, totally. I love that. And I almost, when I'm planning out an album, I'm simultaneously planning out the remix album that comes out at the exact same time with all the other people I love, then taking the music and reinterpreting that because I just love that process. Like I love, again, it comes to that point of like how much I love arrangements and reimagining. Like Laura, one of the singers in the group who you know as well, whose house we're actually in right now, she's just also gone through a process of taking her album and making like an acoustic version of it with harp and cello. And it's just, I love hearing how things can be totally shifted into a totally different kind of energy by just changing the instruments
or the tempo,
the key or anything. Yeah. So it's just, it's so amazing, these, and because I think it also gives credit to the work, the original work. It's just like, that's such a beautiful idea. How can that rebloom and reblossom? Like, how can that gain like a totally different color? I love it. I really love it.
So is the, I know you've got a gig coming up. I mean, probably by the time this comes out, it will be after that gig. So that's the next kind of big show.
That's the next big
show. Are you going to be presenting some of the, I guess it won't be in its final form it's going to be, but works that will feed into that new album.
Yeah, I would hope that this is the it takes me so long to get the live show, like all of the elements when I do change it. Like I've just been mixing it for the last 3 days and it's still not done. So it's just like, I'd only plotted out one day for that. That's why it's so hectic when you came before. But I think there's that I feel needs to be the live show for at least a wee while. But I love that the live show will be, it will be a different experience to the album because I think it's also really important to feel the context. Like some of the stuff, because we originally put out the demos of, well, no, we didn't put them out, but we kind of made a demo album of what we were thinking of doing based on the live pieces. And because I know them so well, I'm like, okay, but I'm like, actually, when I listen to these as a recorded object, they don't work necessarily. Like without the context of like one gets played before the other, or, you know, that some of them don't sit right. So it's like, okay, how, like imagining an album is such a different beast to imagining a live show.
Yeah. And as you can't change it once it's out.
You can't change it once it's out. And also now we're dealing with the fact that in my dream world, I want to make a concept album. I want to make like a classic old like Pink Floyd, like everything runs together and everything, you know, like I want that.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But the nature of how people listen to music now is not there. And you can't have Well, exactly. So, but you can't have a streaming version of an album that cuts off in the middle of a piece. So it's just like, do we create an album that's got a streaming version and a vinyl version that's a totally running together thing? And I'm like, yes, I want to do that. But then that also costs double the amount of money to create. So it's just like, there's so many different facets now of like thinking about, again, because we're totally self-funded, it's like, that's a huge decision. Because everything costs. Same with the amount of people that we can have on stage, like same with the amount of people we can involve in anything. It's just like the financial reality of stuff is like a huge thing. And that's also why someone like Philip is amazing, because she comes from a theater world where they invest much more in the process of stuff rather than just the end result.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what's also kind of magical about this project, is it is a slight antithesis to the traditional music industry model in that we invest so much time into kind of the connection between people, the development of things, that because why not? Especially if we're just doing these slightly one-off massive performances, it feels crazy to like only have all of your energy, and that has to be going into the build up and the presence of like the lead up to that.
Yeah, sure.
As well as the aftermath of that as well. But yeah, the album's going to be so magical. I can't wait. I can't wait. Also, because I mean, we've done so well considering we've actually not really properly released any of our own music. We've got that amazing album with Gazelle Twin, which we were like, you know, that was a very collaborative process. That was very much like both me and Elizabeth, like I arranged all of that music from her original music.
Yeah.
But it's very easy for someone to look at that and be like, oh, that's her album
that you're
the choir on.
And
that's fine also, because we were just starting and we were using the platforms of those people to be lifted up and develop our own thing. But it's going to be so amazing to have our own stuff that's really truly ours out there.
So is the aim to put that out this year, do you think?
Or
do you
think I would hope so. It depends. Again, it's just like we've got funding to kind of make the album. Mm-hmm. We got really generously funded by PRSF to help put costs towards the album. Even that, you know, like it's a generous amount of money, but that still doesn't cover the costs of making the album. And then it's like, how do we put that out? We're still in discussions of like how it gets out into the world. I would love to have it out soon. We've also got a really exciting thing, which I don't think I can really talk about on the podcast yet because it's confirmed. I'll tell you afterwards. Which will, by the time this comes out though, it probably will have been announced, but just in case it hasn't, I won't say anything.
Okay.
But that's another humongous thing, which will hopefully have quite a big range of people connecting in, but yeah, I'm so excited for this music to come out and for it to be just out there, because I think people so much are like, you know, they're listening to a song we did ages ago, or they're like, oh, that song from Deep England. I'm like, oh, I can't wait for just like,
yeah, where yeah. is your head at now?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And also just to then move on to the next stuff, because we've got a lot.
It's all part of the process, hey?
Yeah.
Oh, so exciting.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
I'm really looking forward to hearing that.
Yeah. I'll give you a sneak preview.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, well, lots of stuff to look forward to, Sean.
Yeah.
Yeah, how exciting.
Yeah.
You're going to be a busy boy.
Yeah, I am a busy boy. That's also, you know, that's also part of it. It's just like trying. I think it's really interesting when it is your own, your baby, basically. You know, like I feel like this is really like, it's not just like a, you know, when you've got a job and it's quite high intensity, but you can kind of separate yourself from it. And I have been having some really interesting conversations with people just about how much of your identity and yourself and your energy is in this.
Yeah.
And it's like, who would I be without this? You know, maybe we talk about that in a totally different podcast. Starting to get so quite like expensive, but like, you know, it is, I chuck myself into this so deeply.
But you can tell. And also that is part of what makes it what it is.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
It wouldn't be the same if you were just sort of like had your foot off the
gas. Yeah. You know? And it is. It's like we've created this platform to do all the things we love in one space. It's like all the singers, like all the people who are involved are like my best friends. Like I love them so much. It's like, there is no one I'd rather go like hang out with in the woods and make crazy music with, and like.
But that's so beautiful.
It's so nice, just like, you know, the collab. Like I work really closely with the string player Alicia. We like, they're my favorite person to collaborate with. Like I send them something, they send me something, and it's like we just gel in this magical kind of unspoken musical way that I've never had with anyone, and it's just like they're so phenomenal. And there's that element of it. And then there's the bit that me and Philippa, we're both really incredibly like hyper ADHD brains of like, what about this? And what about this? And messaging each other at 10 p.m. being like, I think we should do this. And then like, what about the color yellow? Did it? You know, like we're so in it and we're both so passionate about it. And that's like a, you know, that's both a blessing and a curse. But like that relationship's really magical. And then we get to do stuff like holding the workshops, which is such an incredible way of like connecting with people. It's not the same. Like you get such a bigger depth with your audience and like when you're working with them.
And also helpful for you, I guess, to kind of as a reminder of like, oh yeah, these are these, you know, the practices that maybe, oh, this week I could really do with this what I'm teaching. That old classic thing, right?
Exactly. And I've got to the point of it now. I was thinking that the other day. I was like, I did 3 workshops in one day, like really intense ones. And I got to the end of it and I then went on to like a Zoom call where we were doing like all this really intense visual meditation, and my meditations were so amazing. And I was like, it's because I've done this work all day, but I've got to the point now with workshops where I can actually be present with the workshop. Like I've done it enough times now that I don't have to be like, and everybody breathe and everybody think, whilst simultaneously be like, and what the fuck comes after this? What's the time? And it's like, does everyone need a tea break? And like, you know, like I really be present with the process. So I am actually receiving from it now. That's which good. Is also, thank God, because it was like the process of getting to that point is actually really difficult. Because you're kind of, and you also feel again like a bit of a hypocrite because you're like, and now we're going to like really be in the body and be really grounded while you yourself are just like listing out those 10 next things that you need to go through. So it's really cool to have gotten to that point.
Yeah, that's quite a process.
Yeah, it's huge, I think. Yeah, so it's like it feeds that, it ticks that box as well. And then, we just, honestly, I feel like the project just draws in so many interesting, amazing collaborators. Like we, like, it's almost like not a week goes by where we don't just get some random cold call email from someone being like, hey, I'm a light artist. Would you like to make a piece in a forest in Japan or something like that? That actually technically hasn't happened, but like stuff like that happens all the time. And we're always just like, tell us more. Like amazing. Yeah. And to think that that's all come through without having any of our own music like properly released is incredible. And quite magical again. So whenever we are performing on stage and there's that sense of like ceremony and ritual and magic happening, I feel like there's some kind of...
There's a ripple.
There's a ripple happening.
For sure.
And And so much comes out of live, real life connections, whether that's in a workshop, whether that's on stage performing to 10 people or, mm-hmm. or like 2000, you know, like the, with so much of the magical opportunity that comes in that's not traditional music industry model mm-hmm. comes our way because we're trying to do things a little bit differently and perform things a little bit differently. So
I think people respond to that as well.
I think
you know?
So, yeah.
It's kind of like, yeah, good for you. You know, yeah. not just the, on a kind of emotional, physical level with the music, but just the way that you're doing it is so creative in itself.
Yeah.
And so full of kind of your own force of nature.
Yeah,
I guess, like,
yeah,
as you
yeah.
say, you know, that's really, I think people respond to that because there's some energy to it. That's like, there's a purity to it in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too.
Wow. Amazing.
What a cool chat.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your time and giving me all that wonderful background. Yeah, I mean, there's so much more we could talk about. Maybe on another one.
Episode two.
Yeah, yeah. I'm especially intrigued about the sort of the pre and post gig sort of aspects.
Yeah, yeah. God, we could go much more deeply into that. I think that's a really important part of it as well. Like, it's just to mention, like, to be aware of how much energy, and I guess this just also just doesn't really get a lot of a platform in terms of, especially, you know, we are talking a lot more about the mental health of performers and, yeah. and musicians and creative practitioners now, but just to be really aware of how much of an opening and a vulnerability that is to share that level of intensity with people. And then to be really aware of the fact that, you know, both the audience, we've constantly got audience members at the end that need assistance because they're just all bawling their eyes out and they can't leave their seats. So we have to make sure that there's loads of space and loads of like ambient music and stuff playing afterwards. And we have to go off stage and we can't do that thing where we come off and all like, oh my God, I did this big thing wrong. Like, you can't go straight into that. You have to come off and you have to do like a full embodied shake for like 10 minutes. Yeah. No one come in and talk to us. Don't go straight to the glass of champagne. Like, let's just ground ourselves back down because you're really opening yourself up to a lot of, like, I can feel that bit in me that afterwards that's like the high is so high, you're reaching for another high or something to hold you back up there. And I think that's a huge thing we could definitely go into later. And it's something that I really see on my friends that are working at kind of high level making and offering out into the world, especially themselves through their art, is like, it can fuck you up if it's not managed properly.
Yeah.
And like, just even starting with that awareness, we're learning. We definitely don't have it down pat, but we are. Is really obvious to me that it's an area of life that needs looking at a lot more so we don't burn out. And
massively.
I say that and I'm still burn out, but I'm trying.
Take a break, Sean. Take a break.
Take a breath.
Take a breath.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time. Where would you direct people to kind of listen to find out more?
I think our website is a really beautiful, well-curated space that me and Philip are constantly put our energy into, and that is nyx-edc.com. And then we also update most things on Instagram. So that is our tag, I think, is nyc.edc. EDC. I feel like my accent's always like...
nyx.edc.
Yeah, that's the one, like Electronic Drone Choir.
Yeah.
Twitter is a good place as well sometimes. God, it's a full-time job just updating all those things, but and then hopefully, as we've talked about before, like, we're gonna get some good new music out there soon, so that will be available everywhere. Our Bandcamp's got the most music up on it. That's the best place to go to find the full back catalog. We haven't released everything on the streamings. Yeah.
Amazing. I think that's a good move as well. Keep some kind of special things for physical and
I think so too.
Watch this space.
Thanks so much, Jody.
Thank you, mate. Thank you.
Loads of love.
You have been listening to Life in Fractals with me, Jody White. Thank you once again to Sean O'Gorman from Nyx, nyx-edc.com for more. You can find me at jodywhite.co.uk, at Life in Fractals on Instagram, and lifeinfractals.substack.com for my writing and more podcasts. Intro and outro music is by Ben Chasney, aka Six Organs of Admittance, with thanks to Ben and Drag City Records. Thank you once again for joining me, and I hope to see you again soon.
Yay! That was a great one!
Thanks, mate. That was great.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks, Cacao.
Wow. That's a rocket ship.
Pinger! We're pinging!
We found our way. The light.